session number 16355, reel 3.
Mr. M's reel 3.
Captain McIntosh, he was the McIntosh of Clan McIntosh, decided enough was enough. He couldn't control his ship, so he had to do something about it, and it was dry docked in Gibraltar. When it was examined, they found out that the packing round the propeller glands, round the rudder posts, the longitudinal support strips and strengthening areas all had to be replaced and restripped, repacked, and there was nearly 500 rivets from the stern area had been blown out of the ship, was letting water in. These had to be virtually replaced. Well, you can imagine that 500 rivets caused quite a lot of flexibility in that part of the ship, and the steering was not quite as it should be. So you can understand why he had to take it in. Well, in the time that we were in dry dock, the aircraft that we'd had on had been flown off into the Gibraltar Strip for servicing, and we as Fleet Air Arm personnel were repairing and reassembling more of the Spitfires that had been left on the dock side. Well, that was hard work, because there was only a limited number of us, and quite a number of aircraft which had been crated and brought out by Argus and dumped on the dockside had been damaged either with foul weather or bad handling. The government managed to get hold of the USS aircraft carrier, the Wasp, at that time, and while we were in dock, she did a run up the Mediterranean, and well, I must admit that the aircraft that she flew off did make quite a valuable contribution to the system that was working. Anyway, back in April we were back in service again. Ship was loaded, we rejoined the convoy, and to our amazement we found that the Wasp was still there. The Wasp was also going down with us, but for political reasons, because the Wasp was still there, the size of the escort was considerably increased. Where normally we would have well, probably half a dozen cruisers, or you know, something, well, not even half a dozen cruisers, probably two cruisers and half a dozen destroyers. There was the battleship, the cruisers, the destroyers, the minesweepers, and there was everything, you know, including the submarines. This was a political gimmick, of course. They couldn't afford to lose an American destroyer. In that sortie, there were about 60 aircraft were flown off between us, because now we had the folding wing type Spitfires. Mind you, this was the first time when we went out, was the first time that Spitfires had been operated outside England. So it was still a novelty, trying to work out the pros and cons of it. Anyway, we flew these aircraft off, and there was a bit of a to-do as we was coming back. Aircraft was shadowing the fleet, but we managed to get back reasonably safe. That was the last we saw of the Wasp. Where it went after that, I don't know. Next trip was a big protection convoy, the Harpoon. And in that convoy, there were 6 merchant ships. Again, we had a battleship. It was the Malaya this time who went down with us, and a considerable escort. And it was a right battle royal again. Well, the disaster was the fact that of the 6 merchant ships that we tried to get through, 4 of them were sunk, and we also lost two destroyers. And coming back to Gibraltar, the Welshman, the fast mainlay, she was with us. She'd gone back through on her own. Her own speed carried her through, because she was much faster than any destroyer was at the time. She went through on her own. But the enemy aircraft who were trailing us back were dropping flares at night time, and we could see these flares, although fortunately for us they were far enough behind that they didn't illuminate any of the ships, so we was able to crawl back. Looking over from the ships to the North African coast, we thought, well, what's going on there? It looks like an electrical storm. Pink lights, green lights, blue lights, white lights, silver lights, the sky was full of them. And although we were in fine weather, it was humid, it can only be an electrical storm. Wasn't until much later we found out we were seeing the reflected flashes, distorted colour-wise and shape-wise, underneath low-flowing clouds from a great artillery barrage that was going on. Fortunately, we were well out of that. Anyway, that set the pattern for some time to come, with various codenamed convoys, Salient, Pickwick, Bowery, and various other things that were named, and with these little ferrying trips in between, where we just shot off more or less on our own and did a quick run and flew them off and came back again. The big one actually came in August, and it was really critical then on Malta. If we didn't get some supplies through of some type, the whole of the situation in that area of warfare would be so completely devastated that Malta was going to be sacrificed. They had to get some through somehow, and this big convoy pedestal was arranged. Now, the sacrificial lamb on this occasion was 59 warships to escort 14 merchant ships. You can imagine among those 59 warships there was some capital ships. Two aircraft carriers of the armoured type, the Victorious and the Formidable. The Eagle, which was not armoured, and coming up in the rear to do a simultaneous fly-off, the same as we had, was the old Furious. So there was four aircraft carriers in that, besides the battleships, the cruisers, the destroyers, the mine layers, the tugs, the motor launches and submarines that was trying to form an escort. It was 59 warships altogether. My involvement in that particular convoy was very minor, in as much as we were quickly torpedoed by the U-73. We were the first casualty of that involvement. The U-73 had actually been laying on the bottom of the Mediterranean for 3 days waiting for us. Like we knew when we went off in the first place where we were going, the Germans also knew that we were coming. They had 6 German U-boats, 16 Italian submarines, the whole of the Italian Navy, and 540 assorted aircraft waiting for us. Well, when we went down, it immediately reduced the capacity, the fighter aircraft capacity, down to about 70 aircraft facing 540. But, as I say, by that time, I wasn't interested. All I was interested in was getting myself out of the situation.
Can you take me through, step by step, your memories
of Operation Pedestal has it affected you, including, of course, the sinking of the Eagle?
Well, the first thing I knew was the fact that there was four distinct detonations, and the ship lurched, and I didn't realise then that we had been torpedoed. Funnily enough, what went through my mind was that we'd hit a school of whales, and I thought, well, where are the whales coming from in this area at this time of the year? It can't be. And then the ship started to list. Then I saw a pair of sea boots hurtling through the air, followed by other debris, and as the ship listed a little bit further, I thought, aye aye, we're in trouble here, what's going on? The list started to develop quite rapidly, and my feet started to slide from underneath me, but fortunately I was on the upper deck underneath one of the 6-inch guns. And then people started to hurl themselves up from the lower decks. And the Marines who were on the upper deck, they started to jump, regardless of orders or anything else. And I saw two of them go over the side and hit the rising torpedo blister as it came out of the water. Well, of course, their legs came straight up through their torsos and they just smashed themselves to jelly and slithered away into the water. No, we really are in trouble if that's the kind of thing, because by that time other people were sliding down the side of the ship. And when I went down over the side of the ship, there were two other sailors there who were clinging to each other in despair. They couldn't swim. A ship's officer came down. I don't know who he was, but he just grabbed one of these sailors in each arm, and I heard him say, now's your chance to learn. And he dived over the side with these two. And the ship's keel was coming up and up and up. I thought, well, if I don't get off here quick, I'm going to be smacked in the face with the keel as it comes up. I'm going over as well. I half blew up my life belt, more or less slithered, jumped, scrambled, and went into the water. Well, by that time there was bodies all the way round, and rubbish and oil, and the ship had slewed completely out of line. And the force of the ship moving actually pushed me away from the ship. That went down about 20 feet, I should imagine. When I did get some sense of recognition of where I was, I looked up and looked round for a lighter colouring of water in the sky to see where the top was from the bottom. Forced my way to the top. My lifebelt was half inflated, and I just looked round floundering, and I was more or less on my own because the ship had been moving and everything was on the drift. I was well away from anybody. Anyway, I started to paddle away in any direction, trying to get my bearings, looked round to see the ship, and I just had time to see the last smudge of it as it disappeared. I thought, oh well, that's the direction that the ship was. Where am I going now? Blow up your life belt, swim, try and find something to cling to, try and find some more human companionship, get out of here best way you can. Luckily I found a spar timber and I clung on to that. Shortly afterwards something bumped into me at the back. I thought, what the dickens is this? And turned round, and it was one of the old crewmen who was on the ship. He'd been the daddy of our mess deck. But I turned to speak to him, but I realised something was wrong. He didn't answer. His eyes was turned back, his face was a funny colour, the water was washing over his face. So I grabbed for him, and as I grabbed, I suddenly realised there was only half a man there. The bottom half had gone. It was just mush, awful. It was just the top half that was floating, kept afloat with his lifebelt. Well, of course, I felt physically sick with that, you know, the shock of it. And I more or less pushed him away. swum around a bit longer. Some time passed and another spar came in my direction, so eventually I had two of these timber bolts and I crossed them in front of me and stuck myself behind and started paddling and kicking away. And I remembered when I was a youngster the little bits of cardboard we used to have, where we used to cut a V out of the back and stick a little bit of camphor in the back and stick it on a washbowl on the top of water, and used to scud round with a chemical action like a little water beetle. I thought, well, there am I. I'm like a little water beetle with these two V pieces in front, the legs kicking up. Then where the dickens am I going? Anyway, I was kicking, spitting, spluttering. Eventually, you either get picked up or you just fall asleep. Eventually, I heard some noises, and I thought, well, I must be dreaming, it can't be. But I looked up and there was another Carly float, and the Carly float was just about smothered with people who'd escaped, so the survivors, and they were all pointing in one direction, and as I looked in that one direction I saw a little ship. Couldn't figure out what it was, but I thought, oh well, try and go in that direction. So I steered my two little spars like a little boat and started to edge my way to it. And as I got reasonably close, I discarded the spars and started to swim on my own. The little boat was the tug Jaunty. Strangely enough, the Jaunty was built quite close to Hull on the ooze here at Selby in Cochrane's Yard. I thought, well, if this isn't like coming home, I don't know what is. Well, there were scrambling nets thrown over the side of the Jaunty and lines thrown over, and I tried to get to it, but I missed one rope altogether. Missed the scrambling net, and I thought, alright, this is it. I'm going to be left behind after all. Anyway, the last rope that I could see, I grabbed, and even though the Jaunty was moving very, very slowly, that rope seemed to scream through my hands and tear the flesh and skin from my hands as it went. Eventually, you know, clung onto it. And as the Jaunty was moving, so I was swung inboard, and I was practically into the rudder and the propeller before I realised that maybe, I have a chance. And I started to pull myself up until I was vertical with the ship's side, and then that was it. I just couldn't pull myself up any further. The weight of my clothing being waterlogged, I just couldn't get my clothing off. Anyway, somebody has tossed another small rope over to get that round your shoulders, and I put one hand on the survivor's rope and one hand twisting round. I got eventually pulled up just like a really hooked fish, and that's just what I felt like. And I was just tossed on one side while the bloke who pulled me in started dealing with somebody else who was coming on board. I was tossed among a heap of writhing and retching humanity, and suddenly somebody said, "Here, get this down your guts. One swig." And it was a mug of navy rum. Well, I don't know if you've ever tasted navy rum, but it can be quite potent, especially when it's not diluted. And a full mug of navy rum going down in one gulp is quite a powerful purgative. Well, quite soon I wished I was back in the water where it was nice and comparatively peaceful. Anyway, we were hailed about and shuffled around as the best way the crew could manage, until eventually there was a big shadow came over the side of the tug, and it was a destroyer. We was asked, well, not asked, but more or less bullied into leaving the Jaunty and getting onto this destroyer somehow. Well, I don't know how many men felt in between and was lost, but we eventually got on the the destroyer, and we had to fend for ourselves. And I got slung down on the deck, and I was so exhausted I just lay there, and the heat of the iron deck came up through my overalls that I was still wearing. It seared my legs, and even to this day I can't grow hairs on my legs. The legs are absolutely, you know, like an adolescent virgin. But that was a small price to pay for being picked up.
Which destroyer was that?
The Campbell.
When the torpedo struck, what had you been doing? Sleeping?
No, it was just after lunch. And we'd gone up on the deck before the actual action stations were sounded. We were at cruising stations, but not action stations. And it was 1:15 in the afternoon. We'd just had midday meal. We'd gone up on deck, and we were supposed to start work again at 1:30. When I say start work, it was continuous work, actually. We never actually stopped, but that was the official breaks. And we were looking out over the convoy, and suddenly there it was. The destroyer that picked me up, by the way, was the Malcolm. I beg your pardon, the Malcolm. And we eventually did get back to Gibraltar. But before we got back to Gibraltar, there was an incident which was one of those strange offshoot things. It wasn't to do with the pedestal convoy proper, but it was a subsidiary effort that was alongside with it. There was the Malcolm and the Lafori, who picked up the survivors, were going back to Gibraltar. That is with the pedestal convoy. But the other effort with the Furious, which had already flown off its aircraft, the Furious had turned back to Gibraltar before we, well, actually while we were being struck, and she'd gone back ahead of us with the Keppel and the Wolverine as the escorts. Now the Wolverine, she had seen on the surface an Italian submarine. It was dark by that time. The Italian submarine was the Dagobert, and it was believed she was on the surface charging her batteries, and because she was battery depleted, she couldn't dive. And the Dagobert actually rammed, the Wolverine actually rammed the Italian submarine, turned it over completely, crushed it to pieces, and just went down with all hands. There was no survivors from that. But the Wolverine's bows were twisted to such a degree that she could no longer be considered as a fighting ship, and she was more or less left to fend for herself. Now, coming up behind us, there was the Malcolm and the Lafori realised what had happened, and the Lafori and the Wolverine changed places. So now there was the Malcolm with the survivors, the Wolverine with the damaged bows going towards Gibraltar, and the Lafori, which had been escorting us with a load of survivors, was already speeding on ahead of us to take up a position to defend the Furious. Well, the Malcolm, which just had to circle round and round and round the Wolverine like a blooming sheepdog until we got back to Gibraltar. Well, by the time we got back to Gibraltar, the Lafori had discharged all the survivors, put its stern down, whistled back up the Mediterranean, and caught up with the convoy and rejoined the convoy. The tug Jaunty, which had picked me up, also had rejoined the convoy, and although she was not designed as a warship, she had at some time been fitted with an obsolete 3-inch gun, and somewhere she got two unofficial machine guns, and while she was with the convoy she actually shot down a Junkers aircraft, something which was quite out of the blue. That's probably why her name was bound down in posterity. We got back to Gibraltar, we were unloaded, and we were given 24 hours to make ourselves presentable, see to the essentials, such as getting kit made up. It was only essential kit that was provided, in my case just a pair of deck shoes, because I was more or less still wearing my overalls. Get the oil cleaned off our bodies and out of our hair, see the MO, and if the MO felt us and we were warm, we was fit, and we was back again on duty. And I was delegated again to go back to the old Argus, which seemed ironical. And I worked our way back to England in the Argus, repairing aircraft which had been damaged and was coming back for major repair. That was my experience of Pedestal. Pedestal, as you know, there's been many thousands of words written about that particular convoy, and of the 14 ships that were the prime object of the exercise, four merchant ships got through and a sinking tanker. But of the four merchant ships that got through, there was 50,000 tons of stores got through, stores, supplies, provisions, and it was just enough to keep things going until the next occasion when supplies could get through. Consequently, Malta did remain as a British possession. When I got back to England after that situation, I went back to my own home port, which at that time was Lee-on-Solent. I was given the usual 14 days leave and sorted things out. And where did I go from there? I've lost track of myself. Switch off.
Could I just ask you, whilst you're thinking, about the fact that you met some survivors of the U-boat that sank the Eagle after the war, and you were telling me the reaction of one of them when he heard how many people had been killed by his submarine. Could you repeat that on the tip?
Oh, yes. Later on, after the war, I found that I had a lot of spare time in my hands, and I decided it was time to re-educate myself. And I was writing a lot of letters to various people, and in the course of those writings, I met the man who had actually fired the four torpedoes which had put down the Eagle. Heinz Metaiga was his name, torpedo mechanica. And in one of the conversations that we had with him, he asked how many people were actually killed when those torpedoes exploded. And I said, well, as far as I know, roughly about 200, apart from other people who died from injuries and who died in the water due to depth charging. Well, as I said, about 200, he himself visibly changed.